So these battles are going on. You know, we're dealing with the now, the present. And that's more than we can handle a lot of times, ain't it? Just dealing with right now. But the Lord is dealing with His angels and His powers. He's dealing with hundreds of years in the future. So these spiritual powers that we see here in Babylon is important because they carry over into the last days. Now, Daniel chapter 2, and let's look at verse 4 through 6. He says, "Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac." Now, the language is changing here. And the book of Daniel up to this point was written in Hebrew. And when you get to chapter 7, verse 28, the Syriac stops. And it goes back to Hebrew and goes the rest of the way through chapter 12 in the book of Hebrew. Now, there's a reason for that, because the prophecies that we're getting ready to study deals with Babylon, and it deals with the kingdoms that follow Babylon. When you get to chapter 8, which is after chapter 7, verse 28, when you start in chapter 8, the prophecies start dealing with Israel again, God's people, so he goes back to Hebrew. Now, don't let that bother you, because Syriac is very similar to the Chaldean, which is very similar to Hebrew, which is very similar to what we call Aramaic. They're ancestral languages. They're very, very close. But the reason that he's doing this is the native tongue of the Chaldeans. And the king, he says, "Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac." They approach him in Syriac. And that's the language that this prophecy that we're talking about right here begins to be spoken. Now, in chapter 2 and verse 5 and 6, let's look at these. "The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, 'The thing is gone from me. If you will not make known unto me the dream and interpretation thereof, you shall be cut into pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill.'" Now, that's kind of a harsh thing. Didn't give him much of a chance to come up with a plan, did he? But I think the king knows that these people right here are about half crooked. And it kind of plays out that way time you get to the end. And look at the next thing that he says here in verse 6. He says, "But if you show the dream and the interpretation thereof, you shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore show me the dream and the interpretation thereof." Because see, he had the dream and forgot what he dreamed. So he's wanting them to come up with a dream and tell him what it means too. And they're trying to buy time, and he won't let them buy time, because he figures if they wait long enough, it'll even be further from his memory, and they could tell him almost anything, and he would believe it. So the king's wise enough to know that he can't give these people too much time. Now, let's look in verse 9. Go down to verse 9. He says, "But if you will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you, for you have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me till the time be changed. Therefore tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me the interpretation thereof." Again, he does not want them to give him much time. In verse 10, and he says this, "The Chaldeans answered before the king and said, 'This is not a man, there is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter.'" Now here's a guy, these Chaldeans, these learned men, which is alongside the astrologers, the magicians, and the sorcerers. They're kind of in a clique. They're all called wise men. I think that's the union, WISE, World Infidel Society of the Euphrates. It's probably some kind of clique they belong to, and probably have to pay dues. And Daniel, he belongs to the Lord, and he's paid up through eternity, so he don't have to belong to the same outfit. But these people right here, he said, "There's not a man that can do this." You know, what are they drawn to pay for? Ain't that under their job description? But now when it comes really down to it, he says that there's not a man upon earth that can show the king's matter. "Therefore there is no king, lord, or ruler that asks such thing at any magician or astrologer or Chaldean." In other words, Nebuchadnezzar, there ain't nobody does this but you. Nebuchadnezzar don't really care. Nebuchadnezzar is the most powerful man in the world at that time. Now look down at the next thing that he says here in verse 11. He said, "This is a rare thing that the king requireth, and there is none other that can show it before the king except the gods." Do you see that little g, plural? So they're kind of reaching out on a limb here, because here in Babylon, they worship many gods. We've seen in that overview, and if you'll get a chance to go into that, there were several temples in Babylon, and they worship many gods. So he says, ain't nobody can do this but the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. So they're trying to brush it off, again trying to gain time here to come up with an answer. Verse 12 and 13. He said, for this cause the king was angry and very furious and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. Look at the next verse. And the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. Daniel got thrown into that. Daniel was probably, it don't indicate Daniel was even present there. He was probably overdoing what Daniel was supposed to do. But now he's got rolled in this thing. When they come after him, Daniel inquires on what's going on because this is the first he heard of it. And look down at the next verse in verse 17. Then Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions. The reason he did is he wants to join together in prayer. Look at the next verse. That they should desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Do you see that? Daniel throwed them under the bus, and I don't blame him. They wasn't concerned about Daniel, and as you see, as time goes on, they're definitely not concerned about Daniel. But look at the next verse. He says, then was the secret revealed to Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. And then he says in verse 20, Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. Daniel takes the time to give honor and glory to the Lord because he knew that's where that this came from. Look at the next verse. And he said, and he changed the times and the seasons. He removed kings and set up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that no understanding. Daniel knows that all these things are things that only the Lord can give. And that's what he's making known as he praises God for what he's doing here. Look at the next verse, 22. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him. In the next verse, 23. And he said, I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers, who hath given me wisdom, because he knew that's where it come from. When he was sent to Babylon, he was already in a position. The Lord had already gave him great wisdom. And he said, and might and has made known to me now what we desireth of thee, for thou hast now made known unto us the king's matter. Now, in Psalms 100, let's look at a couple of verses of Scripture, because this is what Daniel does. And Daniel followed through as he should have. He said, and this is a psalm here that says, enter into his gates with thanksgiving and into his courts with praise. Be thankful unto him and bless his name. And in verse 5, he says, for the Lord is good, his mercy is everlasting, and his truth endureth all generations. That's what Daniel done before he ever went out and presented himself to the king of Babylon and went out to tackle this issue of interpreting this dream. He wanted to be sure that the Lord received honor and glory for his life and what he was getting ready to do. That is the wisest thing that we can do anytime the Lord, we feel like the Lord is using us, is give him honor and glory for what he does in our lives. Look with us in verse 26. He says, the king answered and said unto Daniel, whose name was Belshazzar, he says, art thou able to make known unto me the dream which I have seen in the interpretation thereof? In the next verse, Daniel says, and answering in the presence of the king, said, the secret which the king had demanded, cannot the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers, show unto the king? He answered his question with a question. Did you ever do anybody that way? It drives you crazy, don't it? Somebody will ask you something, then you know, you'll ask them a question. They got to answer your question before they get an answer to your question. And what Daniel's trying to get the king to realize is that all these people he's been paying these high salaries to, these astrologers and soothsayers and these wise men, you know, they're not earning their keep. He said, can't they do no good? Look at the next verse. He says, but there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king of Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Now that's the key to this verse, is that the interpretation of this dream, the effect of it, is the latter days. Now the latter days has nothing to do with Babylon. It has nothing to do with the Medo-Persians. It has nothing to do with the Grecian Empire. It has very little to do with the first Roman Empire. It has everything to do with the 10 toes that we're going to be looking at, hopefully before the night's over. And what he's saying right here he says, what shall be in the latter days, because the latter days is always an expression of what the Lord is going to do with his people right before he returns. Now notice that. He says, and look in Daniel chapter 10, let's look at verse 1 and 14. He said, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a thing was revealed to Daniel, whose name was Belshazzar. We read this earlier, but look close. And the thing was true, but the time appointed was long. I want you to understand that what Daniel was showed throughout his prophecies, many of which reached all the way to the second coming of the Lord. It was not something that would play out in just a few years, but most of what he prophesied was pointed until the very last days at the second coming of the Lord. There is an exception to that in chapter 3 and in chapter 4, but here it is appointed a long term. Look at verse 14. He says, now I come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days, for yet the vision is for many days. So Daniel is given the understanding about this in chapter 10. And the reason I want you to see this, it is things that's going to happen to thy people in the latter days. And Daniel's people was Israel. So when you see in prophecy, when you see latter days, you'll know that there's always a Jew present, and it's always right before the Lord returns back from heaven and establishes his kingdom. That is a rule of thumb that you can pretty well stick with, is that right there. Anybody got a question? Comment right in there. Look with us in verse 31. Now this is the dream. Let's go to the image, Brother Steve, in the wilderness. And this image that the dream is about and what Daniel is getting ready to reveal is this right here. And the theme of our Bible study, it shows a rock coming down, a stone, and breaking the image, but here is before it's broken. This is the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, and Daniel begins in verse 31 to describe this. Now, this thing that he starts off with in this description of verse 31 is this head. He says, thou king sawest, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. And look at the next verse. He says, this image head was of fine gold. Now, Darwin has got everybody evolving. You know, we're getting better and smarter and better looking all the time. You know, we just look around, you can see it just rubbing off on all of us. Me and Fred's having trouble with it, but everybody else is doing pretty good. And he starts off with gold, which is about $1,340 an ounce. And he goes down to silver, which is about $17 an ounce. He goes down to brass, which is bringing about $2 a pound. And then he goes down to the iron, which is about 10 cents a pound, about $195 a ton. I mean, Darwin's got it backwards, ain't it? Because the closer we get to the Lord, the less we're worth. But this kingdom that we're talking about right here is legs of, let's back up one verse, or verse 32. I got kind of here. This image head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass. Now picture that. And then he goes on down to these legs. And he says in verse 33, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Now those two things do not bond. Iron and clay, you can compress them, you can form them and put all kind of pressure on it, but there's nothing there if they're always brittle. They will not bond. But that's what he's talking about in this description right here, in this image that he sees. Now, in verse 31 through 36, this is the dream. But in 37, I want you to look at the interpretation of this thing and what he tells Nebuchadnezzar. He tells Nebuchadnezzar, O thou, O king, art a king of kings. For the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power and strength and glory. And verse 38, and wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beast of the field, the fowls of the heaven, hath he given to thy hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. And can you not see Nebuchadnezzar with that big old grin? Because he is a head of gold. He's got all this power that God gave him. Now, that's a lot to put on a guy. And most people can't handle that sort of thing. And look with us in the book of John, chapter 19, a couple of verses of scripture, because this is where Pilate comes to the Lord, and right before the Lord is taken and put through his mock trial, he says, then said Pilate to him, speakest thou not unto me? Knowest thou not that I have power to crucify thee and have power to release thee? And now, just kind of put that in perspective. Look at the next verse. Now, here's Pilate talking to the creator of the universe. Jesus answered, thou couldest have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above. Now, I think Pilate kind of got a hold of that, because Pilate kind of lost his ego right after that. He says, therefore, he that delivereth me unto thee hath the greater sin. And he's talking about Israel turning them over unto him. Look with us in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 and 27. Now the Lord is making man, and God said, let us make man in our image. And this is before Adam and Eve messed up. This is what they could have had. Let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. Look at the next verse. So God created man in his own image, and the image of God created he him, made male and female, created he them. And this is a condensed of what happens in the next chapter. But what he's saying, it was God's will that Adam and Eve have control over everything. And what they couldn't do, they couldn't control themselves over the tree, the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They gave up power over all and control over all because they couldn't deal with the devil saying, thou shalt not surely die. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, look what happens in this, back in Daniel chapter 2, and he just told him what this, he said, thou art that head of gold. Now, 4:39, this is probably the saddest words this man has ever heard. In verse 39, and after thee. You know, Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel had just got to tell him how great he was. And then he says, by the way, after you. Nebuchadnezzar really thought he was going to be around for a long, long time. Most people think they're going to live forever. At least they live like they think they're going to live forever. And Nebuchadnezzar, when he comes in and said, after thee, you can imagine what's taking place. And chapter 3 kind of expresses that because he makes that image in the plains of Dura out of all gold. And he deifies himself as the one God of Babylon because Nebuchadnezzar, all of a sudden, he wanted to be eternal. Now, really, when you get down to it, don't everybody really would like to live forever? But the thing that they don't want to do is trust God's Son so they can. Because their deeds are evil. Remember what we've seen about the sorcerers, the drug dealers in the last days? They're so absorbed in their life that they're not concerned about their soul. How many people do we see living that way today? They're trying to balance their checkbook and they've got one foot slipping off into hell every day because they're just not concerned about the things that are important. Now we got a couple of minutes here and I want us to go just a little bit further. And he says, in the things that would come after thee. And look with us in Daniel chapter 5, verse 28. And the thing that's going to come after him is this kingdom. He says, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. And this takes place just a few years later. And we know that the kingdom that comes after the Babylonian kingdom is the Medes and the Persian Empire. So we know that from the scriptures. But what I want you to see also is the next thing that he talks about in verse 40. For he says, and the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all things, shall it break in pieces and bruise. Now, look in Luke chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. And I apologize that I've had a drip of nose and stuff tonight. I don't have a fever, but I do have a drip. Luke chapter 2, verse 1 and 2 tells us who's in charge when the Lord comes. And it came to pass in those days that there came, went out a decree from Caesar Augustus, and all the world should be taxed. And look at verse 2. And this taxing was first made when Cyrenius was governor. Do you see that word? Syria. Keep your eyes on Syria. We're going to see it for the next few weeks. It keeps turning up. Now, Rome is in power. Now, what happens when Rome goes in power? And let me give you a couple things to think about. When Rome goes into power, Rome becomes a world power around 30 BC. And it remains in power to 364 AD. Now, in 364 AD, it's divided. And the eastern part of the Roman Empire, it lasts many, many more years. It lasts to 1453. And the western, which is around, centered in Rome and Italy, the western part dies out in 476. Now, the reason I want you to see this is that those legs of iron and those feet of iron and clay are still standing today. Because when the Lord was here, Rome was standing there, and they were standing on the two legs, and those legs extended down, and they stood upon the two feet with 10 toes, and that is where the stone comes and breaks in pieces, and that whole thing falls. But Rome, even though Rome is divided in 364, it exists in the eastern part and the western part for many more years. But here's the catch to the thing. Rome in 380 AD, Nicene Christianity became the church state of the Roman Empire before it fell. 380 AD, before it fell, because this right here is affected more of the western part than it did the eastern, and it was adopted as the state religion. Now, this was done by a man, he is an emperor, he is Theodosius the First, and he proclaimed it as the state religion. Now, in 1054, it split. And it split between the Eastern Orthodox, which is the Church of Russia and the Ukraine area, and the Roman Catholic Church that we see centered in Rome through the Vatican. Now, the reason I want you to see that is there's never been a time when there was not a Roman power. Now, the Roman Empire was legs of iron, but it's still standing today on feet of iron and clay. The iron represents the governmental part of it, and the clay, and we won't have time to go in this, but the clay is what's called the seed of men, and it has to do with the peoples that is involved in it. So today, the Eastern Orthodox, and I don't know if you caught this, but about 2 weeks ago, Vladimir Putin, he baptized himself. He's an Eastern Orthodox, and he baptized himself in icy waters. His daddy was an atheist, and we're going to get dealing with him a little bit later in chapter 7. But here is what you want to see is the Eastern Orthodox is a very powerful church with 250 million people involved in it, and the Roman Catholic is a worldwide church with like 1.3 or almost 1.3 billion. So these are a powerful, and those feet today that we're talking about are made up of the Roman Empire. These churches, this was adopted, the Nicene Christian Church, and the Nicene Christian Church is not the church described in this book right here. If you want to do a little research on that, they are very formal. They're driven by a lot of different things that you wouldn't recognize, but that became the doctrine of the church, and it carries through even today. And there are some similarities between these, but they are different, and that's why they're two different feet. Now, those feet have 10 toes, and those 10 toes are 10 kings that we're going to get into next week. And I'm not sure how this works out, but it appears that five of those kings may come out of the Eastern Orthodox, and five of those kings would come out of the Roman Catholic. I'm not that far yet, and I'm going to put some stuff together. You'll have to help me decide whether that looks fishy enough to say or not. Anybody got a question or comment right now? Yeah, Nostradamus, he was a man that plagiarized a lot of the things that Isaiah said. And it's the same thing that Joseph Smith done when he wrote the Book of Mormons. He plagiarized a lot of the Old Testament and kind of put it in his own words. Most of those people are crooks. And after Joseph Smith died, Brigham Young made the statement that he couldn't understand that God didn't talk to him like he did Joseph Smith. You know, Brigham Young was about half honest, sounds like, and he didn't get them messages from heaven like the other did. But that didn't answer your question, but I flipped it on you. That's a spin, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Anybody got another question or comment? And then 7 and 8. 5, 6, 9. Well, in order of a theme, because what we're seeing in this thing is the prophecies are going between, and it's hard to nail it down. I'm not here to tell you and explain it exactly, but it sounds like when the prophecies change from the prophecies dealing with the Gentiles over to God's people, that the order changes. But now, when he goes to the Syrian, or Cyrus, when he goes to him, the prophecies are seemingly about the Hebrew people, where when he's dealing with Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar, it's more dealing with the times of the Gentiles. But I'm not sure, Tony, but Isaiah is the same way. Isaiah is written there's many things happen before and after. In the New Testament, it's a little bit different. But in the Old Testament, it's not uncommon for things to go in a direction, and then they would back up 50 years and talk about that for a while, then jump 200 years in the future, because prophecy is that way. Prophecy is about the future. So maybe as we get through this thing, Tony, it'll fit together a little bit better. And I will try to spend a little bit of time on that question, and maybe we'll try to do better next week. Anybody else got a comment right there? At the end of the 7 years. Yeah. And that's a good question, Larry Dale, because the first 3 years, 3.5 years of the tribulation is not going to seem real bad for a lot of people, because it's a false peace. He's going to make a treaty, a deal with the covenant with the people of God, the Jewish people, and they're even going to think that everything's doing good. But at the end of the first 3.5 years, he breaks that covenant, and the Antichrist, which has been this great world leader that had an answer for everything, truly becomes the one that shows his true colors, and he destroys the Jew, runs him out of the temple in Jerusalem, and he goes into Jerusalem and sits in the temple of God and rules from Jerusalem. That's 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 that he does that. So it's an interesting thing when you get into the tribulation of all that's going to happen in those 7 years. Matter of fact, just about everything that we're seeing in chapter 7 of the book of Daniel, the last part is going to be congregated within that 7 years. Yeah. Yeah. Chapter 8, he will. He's a vile leader. And the Bible says he obtains his power by flatteries. He's one of those people that can just make everything sound perfect. Yeah. It's all by deception. Anybody else got a comment right in there? I appreciate you being in here tonight.